Good morning, we're delighted to welcome you all to this first December set of arguments, and we are especially delighted to welcome Evansville High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you, it's good having you with us. You may be seated. We also have students from the Barneville School District. Would they stand, please? It's good seeing you all. You may be seated. These students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin in this court. This program is designed to encourage students to learn more about the judicial process. Students from across the state are invited to come attend hearing of this case, and then we'll meet with the justice after the second case. Everybody is invited to join the students to meet with the justice. The discussion with the justice will deal with the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in any of the cases. If anyone here would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, we'd be happy to give you one. All right, let me introduce the court to you all. I'm going to start with the justice on my right, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. She is the justice with whom you will meet after the second oral argument. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, and seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Brooks, and to his left, Justice Patience Robensack. And ordinarily in the vacant chair would be Justice Michael Gableman, but he will not be participating in this case. We'll call our first case, which is 07AP1638, Christine L. Tensfeld versus F. William Haberman. Arguing on behalf of the Tensfelds is Gary M. Young, and Mr. Shrimp, Attorney Shrimp, will argue on behalf of Roy LeBud. Is it Bud or Booty? Buddy. And Michael Beston Friedrich. 5 minutes for you, Mr. Young, in the rebuttal, and 5 minutes for you, Mr. Shrimp, in rebuttal. Mr. Young.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, my name is Gary Young. I'm counsel for the three plaintiffs, Bill Tensfeld, John Tensfeld, and Christine Tensfeld. I'd like to begin by turning to Attorney LeBuddy's cross appeal. We haven't had a chance, obviously, to reply to the points he makes in his reply brief, and I'd like to focus on several features of his reply brief. I'd like to begin by framing that discussion with what I think is the key fact in the cross appeal, at least, and that is that Attorney LeBuddy helped his client, Robert Tensfeld, who's the father of the three plaintiffs, violate Robert's divorce judgment. Robert was divorced in 1974, and his judgment provided, among other things, that he would maintain, in effect, a will leaving his three children, the three plaintiffs, at least two-thirds of his net estate. When Robert went to Attorney LeBuddy for estate planning services, he gave LeBuddy a copy of that judgment, and LeBuddy was familiar with it. LeBuddy then drafted for Robert a series of wills over a period from 1980 to 1992, each of which violated that provision in the divorce judgment. And Attorney LeBuddy was aware of this, that it, he violating that provision. In 1981, and the record reference here is record item 64, exhibit 13, and exhibit 3 at page 43, he wrote Robert and Robert's divorce attorney as follows. In my opinion, Mr. Tensvelt's present will, and that's a will that LaBuddy had drafted and helped Robert execute a few weeks before, I believe. Mr. Tensvelt's present will needs some revision in light of the obligations under the divorce decree. So Attorney LaBuddy knew that the estate plan documents he was drafting for Robert violated the court order that was entered in 1974 in Robert's divorce. That's the key fact relating to Attorney LaBuddy's cross appeal. And it's the fact that led the trial court to conclude that LaBuddy had intentionally aided and abetted Robert's unlawful act. He had committed the intentional tort of aiding and abetting.
And the unlawful act is violating the judgment?
I'm sorry, sir?
And the unlawful act is the violation of the judgment?
That's correct, Your Honor. Attorney LaBuddy has...
Is the divorce judgment in the record somewhere?
Yes. I don't have the citation at my fingertips, and I can provide that to you if you want. It might be in the LaBuddy's appendix.
Appendix 1 and 2. Was the of that estate to the three children, was that part of property division? Was it part of maintenance? What was that labeled in the divorce judgment? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
It wasn't labeled property division. It wasn't labeled support. It was part of what in Rintelman, this court's decision in Rintelman, was described as a comprehensive package for resolving all the financial obligations and relations between the divorcing parties. So it wasn't categorized in any particular way. But as the trial court concluded, in return for making this promise of maintaining the will in effect, favoring his children, Robert received consideration, including getting most of the property and having a lower maintenance.
The maintenance and property division, do you think? Or?
The quid pro quo for the promise to maintain a will was a lopsided allocation of property, the marital property, to Robert.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, sorry, yes, to Robert. But the stipulation and judgment don't call this a property division. Yes.
Mr. Young, let me ask you this. 1974 is the divorce judgment. My understanding is that the death was in 2000. We have a law in Wisconsin that a judgment is valid for 20 years. How does that play into all of this?
Your Honor, it has no effect on this case. And the key citation here is State v. Hamilton, a unanimous decision of this court 5 years ago, which Justice Prosser authored the opinion, in which that 20-year statute of limitations was addressed. And the court made it clear that whatever the effect of that statute of limitations might be, it did not mean that after 20 years, you could not bring a contempt action against somebody who was in violation of an ongoing obligation to the court.
Counselor, how does the obligation become ongoing after 1994?
It was ongoing before then.
But he didn't die before then. So how was it ongoing between 1994 and 2000, the date that he died?
It was, I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor, but...
Well, let me just tell you what's bothering me. As I read your arguments, it seems to me you're saying that he couldn't have changed his will after the 20 years ran. So say he wrote a will that was in compliance with the divorce judgment.
Then in 1995, he wrote the same will that was probated. Is he in continuing contempt once the judgment has exceeded 20 years in length?
He would be in contempt as of 1995 when he wrote the nine. And
but the judgment would expire in 1994, according to the 20-year statute.
Or
make it 96, just so you're sure it's outside the 20 years. That's what bothers me.
If that were the effect of the 20-year statute, the statute of limitations here is, and the court had some concern, I think it was pretty clearly expressed in State v. Hamilton about this. It seems to result in some unusual consequences, but it was an act of the legislature. But what the court made clear in Hamilton was that this 20-year statute does not mean that you are suddenly relieved of obligations, non-monetary obligations at least, and this was more of an injunction than a requirement to pay a specified amount. You're not relieved of those simply because the 20 years runs.
I guess, you know, when I look at what was addressed in Hamilton, I see a significant difference here because I don't see anything in the judgment that does a couple of things. He could have transferred all of his property inter vivos to a trust. There's nothing in the judgment that prevents him from doing that. Just talks about his net estate, and that's a defined term. He could have made the same will he made. He died in 2000, say he made it in 1999. It would have been outside the force of the judgment. That doesn't mean his obligation is eliminated, and the contract to make a will was enforced in the Florida courts, as I understand. So the contract was interpreted to be freestanding by the Florida court and enforced. But what you're asking for is us to say the judgment itself is enforceable, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm having some difficulties when you can change a will under our law at any time you want. And he could have made this will in 1999. It wouldn't have been in violation of any judgment.
Well, our position is it would have violated the 1974 judgment because if you read the statute of limitations to mean that all the provisions in the divorce judgment, 1974 divorce judgment, are gone after 20 years, then you get some very bizarre results. Are they still divorced after 20 years?
Well, divorce is a status element of a divorce judgment, according to all our case law, where property division and rights and maintenance and child support are financial and they're not status. We could say the statute of limitations doesn't apply at all to divorce judgments. I mean, you haven't made that argument. But we could say that. But I'm having a lot of trouble, given the fact you can always change a will, given the fact he could have made this will in 1999, it just concerns me. I think the obligation is there. I agree with you, and I think the Florida court agreed with you.
The obligation, though, is not merely contractual. It is also under the judgment. And the statute that we're talking about, 893.40,
mm-hmm.
Historically seems to, the history is murky. We've tried to look into this and figure out where this statute came from, going back into common law and so on. And it's not clear, but the history seems to be this is primarily addressed to money judgments. Judgments which say the defendant debtor owes the creditor plaintiff X dollars. If the plaintiff creditor does not do something about that judgment within 20 years after the judgment's entered, then it's too late. There's an element of finality here that makes sense because if you can't take care of this financial obligation, the money judgment within 20 years, and you don't go back to court and ask for an extension, then that's it. But when you have more injunctive type relief, which this really was. It was an order to Robert to do something and keep this will in effect until he died, obviously. Then the 20-year cutoff really doesn't promote finality. Instead, it promotes the abrogation of rights that were given under the divorce judgment.
Well, you could re-record a judgment under the statutes and extend its limitation period. My understanding is that wasn't done here.
I believe you can, but I don't believe that was necessary with a non-monetary aspect of the divorce judgment.
Okay.
Counsel, I'm interested in the vitality of the judgment after 20 years also. And I think as a former circuit court judge, of the number of judgments of divorce that I have out there that might have a provision such as this, that the husband has to keep the wife or the children as beneficiaries of a life insurance policy, or has to keep the wife or children as beneficiaries under a retirement plan, or some kind of designation like that. And I would pause to think that after 20 years, those obligations are extinguished, especially when there's a quid pro quo during the property division vis-a-vis these kinds of arrangements. But then you have the Hamilton case. How do you distinguish, or how can you get around the Hamilton case that dealt with child support? Is your answer solely the injunctive relief that you just gave?
What the court ordered Robert to do, what Robert said he would do in open court in his divorce case, was maintain a will in effect. He didn't, there was no promise that the will would give specific amount of money to anybody. It was that Robert would do something and keep doing it, obviously, until he died. So that is not a money judgment, and the way we would distinguish Hamilton is that Hamilton dealt with child support arrearages. That was for a specific amount, I think, I don't remember, $2,000 a month or something, that the state had brought an independent action after the mother had died to collect from the father the child support arrearages. That was a specific money judgment that they were asking for, and that makes it very distinguishable here from the breach that Robert committed with LaBuddy's help.
Mr. Young, I've got another problem or concern in all of this, and it has to do with full faith and credit. We've got, first of all, as I understand it, an action in the state of Florida, probate action. And in the probate action, I understand that the trial judge and the Florida Court of Appeals took the approach that this was a contract obligation. Now we shift over to the state of Wisconsin, Judge Nowakowski, and my understanding is he goes on the idea of contempt and continuing contempt. What did he do with the contract aspects, the finding of the Florida court, if anything?
Your Honor, I believe the Florida decision, at least the Court of Appeal decision, said that the Tensbelt children had a viable contract action that was not barred under Florida law, and they said that the Tensbelt children also had an action based on the divorce judgment as distinct from the stipulation or contract. But the divorce judgment action was barred under Florida law because the judgment had not been domesticated in Florida within 5 years of its entry in Wisconsin. And so that was a peculiarity of Florida law. We're not in Florida. We're not bound by the Florida statute of limitations regarding domestication of foreign judgments. And so both of these claims, the contractual or stipulation claim and the claim based on the divorce judgment, the court order, are independent. They have lives of their own, and we're relying now at least on this summary judgment motion and the appeal from the motion, the decision, we're relying on the fact that this was a violation of a court judgment, a court order. And the question of whether there was a violation of the stipulation and the extent to which Labuddy might be liable for helping Robert violate the stipulation isn't before this court.
So you don't see the action of Judge Nowakowski at the circuit court level here failing to give full faith and credit to the action taken in Florida. You don't think they're inconsistent?
I agree. I don't see Judge Nowakowski's decision as inconsistent in any way with what the Florida Court of Appeal did. The Florida Court of Appeal relied on a specific Florida statute of limitations, which is irrelevant in Wisconsin.
All right, thank you.
Judge Nowakowski made a finding about aiding and abetting a violation of a court judgment. Is that right?
Yes.
What are the elements of that?
Of aiding and abetting? That Attorney Labuddy engaged in conduct which, looked at objectively, aided and abetted the commission of an unlawful act. That's the first element in Winslow v. Brown. And the second element is that he did that knowingly and deliberately. And I don't believe there's any dispute about either of those elements, except that Labuddy says it wasn't an unlawful act because the divorce judgment was not enforceable.
Counselor, is there any kind of I know statute of limitations were raised in the answer. You're talking about an intentional tort, but nobody has briefed for us whether you can even bring an aiding and abetting action in, when did you bring this? In 2007, I guess, the aiding and abetting occurred in 1992. Is somehow the statute of limitations taken care of so that that's not a concern for us?
It's not. It has not been argued either before Judge Nowakowski or on appeal.
Okay.
So the only statute of limitations issue I believe that's before this court is the one...
The 20-year one?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
We still have a cause of action in contempt?
Yes.
Against the lawyers?
Yes, for an intentional tort? Yes.
Is that still pending in the circuit court?
The issues pending, let me see if I can put it in a nutshell, what's still pending in the circuit court. We had an intentional tort claim for conspiracy against Labuddy. He moved for summary judgment dismissing that, and Judge Nowakowski denied that motion. On the other hand, we didn't ask him to grant summary judgment in our favor on the conspiracy claim, and as far as I can tell from the briefs on appeal, Labuddy has not addressed that conspiracy claim on appeal. I think it was part of his notice of cross appeal, but it's not developed at all in his brief. So I think that's still in the circuit court. We have negligence claim against Attorney Labuddy, but that's the question of whether the 1012 have standing to bring that is before this court. Beyond that, the merits of that claim are not before the court. I believe those are the main, well, there's also damages, including punitive damages against Attorney Labuddy.
Against whom?
I'm
sorry? Punitive damages against whom?
Punitive damages against Attorney Labuddy. Judge Nowakowski.
Well, what about contempt? Or aren't the lawyers liable for contempt because the judgment didn't go to them? I'm looking at Hamilton, and Hamilton says, oh, this is 893.40 is plain language, and it's a statute of repose, not a statute of limitations, and then winds up and says, in effect, hey, contempt proceedings remain a viable option for persons aggrieved by a parent's refusal to pay child support. Now,
the attorneys here weren't governed by this judgment, so I don't know if there's contempt against them.
We're not saying that Attorney Labuddy would be subject to contempt. The 20-year statute of limitation enters the discussion as support for Labuddy's contention that the divorce judgment was not enforceable. And if the divorce judgment was not enforceable, then his violation of it was not unlawful, and then Labuddy's aiding and abetting in that violation was not aiding and abetting an unlawful act. But we're not saying, I don't believe anybody has suggested that the 20-year statute of limitations applies to our action against Attorney Labuddy, if I understand your question rightly.
The other thing about your brief that I was curious about is, and maybe I missed it, but the only place I found you talking about Michael Best was at page 23 of your combined brief of appellants and cross-respondents. Then you just say, Michael Best would be liable for both Labuddy's and Hoberman's shares. In other words, the entire amount.
Yes.
And what's your basis for that?
Michael Best is liable for Labuddy's damages on the theory of respondeat superior. Michael Best is liable for damages Haberman owes on the theory of respondeat superior. If you have a pot of damages, you can't figure out how much of those are allocable to Labuddy's conduct, how much to Haberman's conduct. It doesn't matter because Michael Best will have to pay no matter what.
Well, aren't they an LLP? What does that mean? Michael Best is an LLP, limited liability partnership.
I'm having trouble hearing you, Your
Honor.
Sorry.
Mr. Young, Michael Best and Friedrich is LLP. How does that affect the liability?
Nobody has denied that Michael Best is not liable for Haberman and Labuddy's damages because of that. That's not an issue in this case. The only issue Michael Best has raised is that the two individual actors are not liable, and therefore Michael Best is not liable.
All right. Counselor, one thing you haven't addressed is your cross-appeal in regard to Attorney Haberman. Do you want to spend a minute or two on that, please?
Yes, I have a yellow light on. I don't know how much time I'll have, but two key points, I think. Number one, there's no dispute that Attorney Haberman was negligent. His misconduct did not rise to the level of Attorney Labuddy's, but it was clearly negligent. He did not advise Robert about a quirk in Florida estate planning law that resulted in Robert's estate plan documents having a very different effect than Haberman told Robert they would have and that Robert believed they would have. So the negligence is established. The only questions before this court are what damages did that negligence cause? And the way to look at that question is to ask, what if Haberman had advised Robert correctly about Florida law? You know from reading the briefs that the issue involved in Florida law was whether Robert's second wife, Connie, could both elect against the will, take 30% of the estate up front under the Florida statute, and then still receive benefits under the inter vivos trust into which the will poured the residual estate. In most places, you can't do both. You can't double dip, because once you elect against the will, you're treated as having predeceased the testator, and you're out of the picture.
But Judge Nowakowski agreed with your assessment, and I don't think that's hotly disputed by your opponents, but what he said is that this exhibit, I think it's number 92, which is the handwritten notes of Attorney Haberman, you couldn't tell from that whether he would have changed the will or he wouldn't have changed the will if he'd had more information, so the damages were speculative, correct?
I believe that that's the position that Attorney Haberman takes. I don't think that Judge Nowakowski addressed that exhibit at all. I don't recall. recall him.
I thought he said the damages were speculative in regard to the proof that was provided. Maybe he didn't rely on this exhibit, though.
He didn't say damages are speculative.
Okay. Right.
The one concern we have about his conclusion is that he never looked at the two exhibits that you're referring to, Attorney Haberman's handwritten notes, and then his memorandum to the file later saying that I reviewed Robert's estate plan with him carefully, and he decided he didn't want to change anything.
Right. But neither of them say anything about the gift to Constance, correct? Neither the note to the file nor the handwritten document that apparently he went over with Robert say anything about specific gifts to Constance.
I'd have to look at them.
I'm going to lead you astray on that comment. At the top it says your children and it says Constance, and I think he assigns two houses to her, one in Florida and one in Delafield. So to that extent there is, and then it doesn't say anything other than that, but it does say below the trust income. So you're saying that that's the gift to Constance.
Well, the trust income wouldn't be a gift to Connie, but actually, since all this is passing at Robert's death, it would all be a bequest, but mm-hmm. Those would go to Connie, yes.
Okay, all right, thank you very much.
I see I have a red light. Unless there are more questions, I will.
Thank you, Mr. Young. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Schrimm, representing LaBuddy and Michael Best and Friedrich.
Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, my name is Tom Schrimm, representing the defendants, respondents, and cross appellants. Also present today are Mr. Haberman and Mr. LaBuddy, as well as Mr. Margolis, who represents Michael Best and Friedrich. The issues in this case ask this court to really answer the fundamental question: under what circumstances will a lawyer face liability to third parties for the legal advice and assistance they provide their clients? More fundamentally, the issue is, who is a lawyer's client? Are they to be concerned with the interests of their client, in this case, that was Robert and Connie, or must they, when they provide legal services and assistance to their clients, must they also be concerned with the rights and obligations of third parties, in this case, the Kensdale children, possibly Connie's children, possibly other individuals? We believe this is primarily a public policy issue, and we believe that the issues can be decided based upon well-established precedent in this case, or well-established precedent that this court has established in the past, based upon sound public policy principles. I want to address briefly the Haberman issues. And generally the rule is that a lawyer is not liable to third parties for advice and legal services they provide to their client. And in this case, again, Mr. Haberman's clients were Connie and Robert Tenstill. What the plaintiffs are attempting to do is shoehorn the Ulrich exception to liability and try to fit their case against Mr. Haberman under the Ulrich exception. Now, what Ulrich provided was that a beneficiary named in a will can maintain a claim against a drafting attorney if the testator's intent, as expressed in the will, was frustrated by the negligence of the testator's attorney. And in Ulrich, the facts are fairly simple. We had a will with a named beneficiary. By reason of the negligence of the testator's attorney, the will was improperly executed. So the court could look at the will, determine, yes, it should have been executed properly. The beneficiary should have benefited from the request. Therefore, there was a legal malpractice claim. There was no doubt in that case about the testator's intent. Here, I think you have to recognize that the intent of Robert's estate plan, as it existed on the date of his death, was frustrated primarily by the fact that Connie filed her re-election against the will, and also that the Tenskell children filed their claim against the estate for two-thirds of the net estate based upon the prior stipulation. Unlike Ulrich, there is no written document to establish what Robert's intent or what Robert would have done had he been advised by Mr. Haberman of the impact of the Bravo decision. So in other words, what we have to do is speculate as to if a conversation that never took place had taken place, what Robert would have done under those circumstances. We believe to extend liability under those circumstances is just bad public policy. First of all, again, Mr. Haberman owed his duties to Robert and Connie by allowing the Tensco children standing to pursue their claims against Mr. Haberman. You're going to drive a wedge between his undivided loyalties so that he would not only have to consider when providing estate planning advice not only the interest of his clients, but also the interest of the Tensville children and possibly Connie's children.
Mr. Shrimp, let me ask you, and I want to stop you right where you are. It's my understanding that Mr. Haberman testified, I can't remember if it was by deposition or testified personally, in Florida, and indicated what he believed the testator wanted to happen. Why isn't that appropriate to consider in regard to Mr. Haberman?
What Mr. Haberman was testifying about is what Mr. Tensfeld intended to happen with respect to what his will stated.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not admissible for Mr. Haberman, because he would have no personal knowledge as to what Robert would have done had he been advised of the Bravo decision. And number two, with respect to his testimony, and also with respect to the evidence, the appellants have cited, okay, really is not a statement of fact to the court. All it is a argument by the personal representative as counsel for, in that case, the Tensville children. And therefore, it's not admissible with respect to Robert's intent or what he would have done had he been advised of the Bravo decision.
Was that the ruling of Judge Nowakowski?
What Judge Nowakowski ruled was that, short of speculation, and that's all we had was speculation as to what Robert would have done had he been advised of the Bravo decision. And when Mr. Haberman was questioned by Mr. Young at his deposition, and we set that forth in his brief, Mr. Haberman testified he didn't think that Robert would have changed his will for various reasons. And the comment was, well, that's speculation. And Mr. Haberman agreed, we just don't know. And therefore, to extend the our duty under those circumstances just isn't warranted. Would also like to point out, I think, that allowing the Tensville children to proceed would be the equivalent of judicial will drafting, which has been prohibited by this court since the estate of Connolly. And I think if you look at the facts in the estate of Connolly, there's even a stronger situation under the facts of that case for the court to assume or infer what the testator's intent was. In the estate of Connolly, you had a will where you had a disinheritance clause of the heirs at law. You had a residual beneficiary, but no provision what happened to the estate if the residual beneficiary died. Obviously, what happened in that case is the beneficiary died before the testator. The heirs of the beneficiary claimed they were entitled to the residual estate. The court said, no, they cannot ascertain from the will what the testator's intent would have been under those circumstances, and we are not going to engage in judicial will drafting. And for that reason, the court did not allow the beneficiaries to recover. Opening the door in this case, I think, creates a situation where any beneficiary could come in and claim based upon a conversation with the testator, based upon a conversation with the testator's lawyer, that somehow they were disinherited or lost something in the estate. We think that's a very dangerous precedent and should not be allowed by this court.
Counselor, there are essentially two claims against Attorney LaBoudet. Aiding and abetting and malpractice. In regard to the aiding and abetting, I think opposing counsel agrees that in order for that claim to stand, the judgment has to to be valid in Wisconsin. Would you give me your best argument on why the judgment is not valid?
Several reasons. First of all, with respect to the statute of limitations, the counsel overlooks, and which is very important, is that at the time, starting in 1985, Robert Tensfeld was no longer a resident of the state of Wisconsin. He was a resident of the state of Florida. And Florida has a similar statute of limitations as with respect to the state of Wisconsin, that is a 20-year statute of limitations. When the Tensfeld children tried to enforce their claim against the estate based upon the divorce stipulation and judgment, they argued both the statute of limitations, the defense was raised that it was barred by the statute of limitations both with respect to the contract and with respect to the judgment. On appeal, they took the tact that although maybe the judgment was not enforceable, the stipulation or the agreement to make a will, the statute did not run until the time of Robert's death. They prevailed on that argument. But with respect to the action on the judgment, the Court of Appeals in Florida was very clear that the statute had run, and they even noted in their decision that it seemed odd to them that the statute could run on the executory part of the contract or the judgment, but that that was along the state of Florida, and they were compelled to abide by it.
So well, they said that the judgment was not enforceable, at least in this state. They qualify that, because when I first read the decision in the briefs, I thought, well, do we have claim preclusion here? How are we saying now the same judgment is valid in Wisconsin? But the Court of Appeals was very clear when they said not in this state. So I don't know what the trial court did. I didn't read that. I did read the Court of Appeals decision.
But again, Justice Rogenczak, the fact is that Robert Tensfeld was a resident of the state of Florida at the time of his death, even 10 years prior to that time, at least. And for that reason, we believe the Florida statute of limitations should control.
So in regard to choice of law, you're saying that because he was a resident, Florida is the place where this claim to enforce the judgment should have been made.
And that's where it was made, against Robert Tensfeld.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
With respect to the second reason we don't believe this judgment was enforceable is the Barnes case. And the Barnes case obviously held, the Court of Appeals held, based upon the Estate of Acaro case, which was decided in 1965, was that agreements in a divorce to provide estate planning for adult children was not allowed and were unenforceable. And we think this case is a prime example why the Barnes case was a very wise decision. This divorce took place in 1974. And maybe it made sense at that time, but as you went through time, obviously circumstances changed. When Robert first saw Mr. Labuddy in 1980 or 1981, he had been married to Connie for 6 years. And he was married to Connie for 25 years at the time of his death. So it would be natural that he would want to provide for his adult children, I mean, for Connie at the time of his death. Also, the assets that he owned in 1974 had changed dramatically since 1974. The third factor is Robert, for his lifetime, with the aid and assistance of attorney Labuddy, made them wealthy individuals. In 1985 or 86, as part of Robert's overall estate plan, Labuddy assisted Robert in transferring to each of the Tensfeld children in excess of $1.7 million. So this is not a case where Robert just carelessly ignored his children or ignored his obligations under the divorce stipulation. In fact,
of what import, excuse me, is the $1.7 million? It seems to go to the facts of this case, but how does that affect the law? Wouldn't the law in this case be just the same, whether it was $30,000 or $1.7 million?
I believe you're correct on that, but I think it is important in terms of under what circumstances this court has allowed a third party to proceed against a lawyer. And I think the law in this case has been that absent fraud or malice, a lawyer is not responsible to third parties for acts and assistance provided to their clients during the course of performing legal services.
Is that the Strid versus Condrus case you're talking about?
It is. That's the initial case.
Immunity does not apply when the attorney's acts, however, in malicious, fraudulent, or torturous manner, which frustrates the administration of justice. That's at 429 and 430 of Congress. Why doesn't this frustrate the administration of justice?
I don't believe it does, and there's two reasons. First of all, in terms of the quote, we believe, that you just made,
yes. Mm-hmm.
If the actions frustrate the administration of justice, again, the court is referring to reprehensible conduct by the lawyer, as opposed to the lawyer providing legal services to his client. I think we have to keep in mind that the client in this case was Robert. It was his obligation to comply with the divorce judgment or the stipulation in order to make a will. That was his obligation, not Mr. Labuddy's. He had a right to receive from Mr. Labuddy's advice and opinion as to how he was to address the problem of the divorce stipulation with respect to his plans and his desires with respect to estate plan.
But the case that I just cited, the Strid case, and the quote that I just cited, deals with liability to third parties. And essentially, it says, as I indicated, that the immunity from liability to third parties extends to an attorney who pursues in good faith. That's something that's fairly debatable. However, immunity does not extend in third-party matters. If there's torturous conduct that frustrates the administration of justice.
But the issue here is torturous conduct by the lawyer. And Mr. Labuddy did not commit any torturous conduct.
Did he not commit any torturous conduct, your argument is, because there is no violation of a court order because the 20 years has run? Is that the argument?
That's part of it, but it even goes back over to that. When a lawyer is giving advice to a client, he is allowed, with respect to his client, to make an error in judgment. And if you go back and look at the testimony, when Mr. Labuddy looked at the divorce judgment and stipulation, it was his interpretation that this was an agreement to make a will that stood outside the judgment, that was independent of the judgment. His advice was based upon that assessment. And it's clear that lawyers do it all the time, that they advise their client and assist them, for instance, in making the decision whether or not to honor a contract. Mm-hmm. That was Mr. Labuddy's assessment of how this played out.
Isn't that a question to be determined then, if it's a fairly debatable thing? That is fairly debatable under the law, Strid talks about, or if it was as painted by your opposing counsel in reference to the Exhibit 13 in Record 64 and Exhibit 3, page 43, that he knew it. He knew it was violating the court order. I mean, that's what your opposing counsel says, yes. The record reflects. Yes.
Mr. Labuddy's testimony was that his interpretation was that it was a contract that was outside of the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, that is a fairly debatable question. Number one, his assessment of the import of that document. Number two, I think as it's recognized, judgments don't last forever. And in this case, we do have a statute of limitations, so that thereafter, and I don't think there's any problem with a lawyer advising a client with respect to this type of situation, that these are your options.
I'll tell you what bothers me, and I want to, so that you can address it, and it's this. I want to just change the facts a little, but maybe exaggeration to emphasize this premise of law that you're advancing. Let's say it's 19 years after a divorce judgment, and the divorce judgment has the same provision here, also has maybe a provision that kids are to be made beneficiaries of any policies of insurance, and you keep the policies of insurance in effect, you know, some good, solid policies of insurance. And it's 19 and a half years after the divorce judgment was entered. And
a person goes to an attorney and an attorney says to the client, hey, you know, it's worth a risk. This is 19 and a half years. You know, you're going to do it. It's under the radar. 6 months, 20 years will pass. I know the court order says this, but what the heck? You got new life. You got a long standing. Now you got new kids. I mean, you don't have to follow that court order. No one's going to know. Bingo, bango. Bongo. no one's going to know. So, 6 months from now, judgment will be extinct. That bothers me, because if I had that as a disciplinary action, and it was an attorney advising a client to violate a court order, and then someone came to me and said, oh, you can't, there's no discipline action here, judge, because 20 years has passed, and it's no longer a valid judgment. I mean, there's something that bothers me about that argument, both in my hypothetical, if that were made, but in the argument here. If the facts are as your opposing counsel would advance, that it was an intentional disregard of a court order, help me with that, if you would.
I think, again, we have to look at it from the standpoint of the attorney-client relationship. The client comes to the lawyer with a problem. A real legal problem in the instance of a court order has different needs and different changes. The lawyer has to assess what those clients' options are under the circumstances. And I think as Mr. Labuddy counseled his client, he said you can first of all comply. Second, you can attempt to negotiate a settlement with your children. And he told them, obviously with respect to your children, you're going to have real consideration pass forward. His third option is, your third option is you don't have to comply, but you're going to face ramifications. Under those circumstances.
But he did more than advise, he drafted it. He drafted it, arguably inconsistent with a court order.
And the reason he did that was because Robert Tensfield asked him to do that. That was his decision, and Robert's decision alone, with respect to how he wanted to proceed and what he wanted to risk.
But if a client tells a attorney, I want to do something in violation of a court order, as long as the client says that to an attorney, it's okay for an attorney to do it?
And I think it depends upon the circumstances. You know, in the Manis case of the United States Supreme Court, where you had a client on the witness stand, and a court ordering the client to testify, and the lawyer goes, advises them not to answer. Again, that's the client's decision, but the attorney, I think, was under his rights and obligation to provide his clients his options and let the client choose what he should do. As long as the lawyer doesn't step outside the bounds of rendering legal services to his client. And there's certain exceptions to that. We recognize that. First of all, in the instance of fraud, an attorney can't participate in a fraud. Number two, the second situation would be criminal activity. I don't think an attorney under those circumstances can advise or assist his client in committing a crime. Third, I think if the lawyer acts with actual malice or acts with an interest outside of the scope of the attorney-client relationship, under those circumstances, I think a lawyer should be exposed to liability. But under the situation where a third party attempting to sue the lawyer for the advice and assistance he gives his client, we do not believe a cause of action exists under the case law that has existed in the state of Wisconsin and has been reaffirmed, I think, nationwide, particularly with respect to the claims where third parties have brought aiding and abetting claims against a lawyer for aiding in the breach of fiduciary duty. I think that's a better rule of law because it preserves the attorney-client relationship, preserves the fact that the lawyer will give frank legal advice to his client without the fear of the lawyer's own liability. And I think that's really what the issue is in at this case. This isn't a situation where Robert has been charged with contempt of court and is being brought in to be enforced by the court. This is a situation where Mr. Labuddy made an assessment, provided his client with sound legal advice, and let his client make the decision.
Counselor, in your affirmative defenses, it is alleged that the plaintiff's claims are barred by the applicable statute of limitations, and aiding and abetting is an intentional tort. Is there a statute of limitations problem that is in regard to that action that occurred in 1992 with this claim that was brought subsequently?
No, there's not. Okay. And the reason I can explain that is it's, again, based upon the discovery rule.
Okay, so you think the discovery rule applies essentially to that particular tort as well as negligence?
And the second reason is because the underlying really stipulation was not enforceable until the time of Robert's death.
Well, the contract certainly wasn't enforceable until the time of Robert's
right.
death. Well, and probably the whole thing, because he could change his will at any time.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Are there any, should you prevail, are there any causes of action still pending in the trial court?
Should we prevail on any?
This lawsuit.
It's our position that, first of all, that the decision of the trial court with respect to Haberman should be affirmed. With respect to the claims against Attorney Labuddy, we believe that the decision of the trial court should be reversed, and that based upon both the immunity defense as well as the good faith advice defense, that all claims against Attorney Labuddy should be dismissed as well.
Well, we're reviewing summary judgment, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Is there an obligation to have done an unlawful act in regard to the conspiracy claim as there is as an element of the aiding and abetting claim?
We believe there isn't. This whole notion of an unlawful act, when we think of an unlawful act, we think of violating
a criminal statute.
A criminal statute. Not under these circumstances, in a broader sense, by breaching a contract could be deemed an unlawful act. That's not what this court or the decisions have talked about. We're talking about criminal action, and that does not exist here.
Okay, thank you.
To violate a court order, seems to me that's unlawful. May not be criminal, but it's not a breach of contract either. Assuming this judgment was valid, let's assume the judgment is valid, been re-recorded so it's now extended for another 20 years, would it be an unlawful act to then draft a will and have a will that, when the person dies, violates that judgment?
Again, using the common nomenclature of unlawful act, using how we commonly understand what an unlawful act is, I don't believe so, especially with respect to this divorce judgment. If you look at the judgment itself, I think paragraph 4 of the judgment talks about how Robert could be charged with contempt for failing to pay alimony, the aspects of property division, or other payments. The contempt provision does not extend to his agreement to make a will.
So you want this case to stand for the proposition that if there's a divorce judgment, and it's a valid divorce judgment, that a lawyer can advise his or her client to take steps that violate that judgment. Like, in the example that Justice Bradley gave you, a change the beneficiary under an insurance policy.
Again, we believe under the circumstances that this case should hold absent fraud, malice, or other reprehensible conduct. It's the client's obligation with respect to the...
Isn't it reprehensible for a lawyer to engage in drafting documents that violate a court order?
Not under the facts of this case.
But if he did knowingly. If the facts were that he did knowingly draft a document in violation of a court order. We're talking about Mr. Labuddy. We're not talking about the other defendant.
But with respect,
Mr. Haberman.
With respect to Attorney Labuddy, again, I think we must keep in mind what his interpretation of the document was. And number two...
Well, was his interpretation of the document?
His interpretation of the document, again, was that this was a stipulation or an agreement to make a will that survived outside.
So it's okay if the lawyer drafts a document that's a breach of contract, but not if it's a stipulation, and not if it's a part of a judgment that's of the court. So you want it narrower than that.
And I still maintain that under the again, we have to look at the factual circumstances and what the overall intent was. And under the circumstances presented in this case, we think the body was entirely within his rights and grounds. And number two, I think the important part is that here we're addressing the buddy's liability to a third party, as opposed to a different situation, I think, with what you may be aiming at, and that's with respect to some sort of ethical violation.
Well, how do I know when a stipulation is a contract and when it's part of a judgment?
I think if you look at the state of Vaccaro.
Well, I'm looking at the judgment in Jefferson County. But the stipulation heretofore entered into by and between the parties is fair and reasonable, and the court approves the same, and the same is incorporated as part of the judgment. A copy of said stipulation is attached hereto and made a part hereof. Further, that pursuant to defendant's stipulation in open court, defendant shall be responsible for the discharge of all liabilities and obligations of the defendant as set forth in said stipulation, and shall hold the plaintiff harmless for any payment on any of said obligations. How can you make it more? How can you make the stipulation more part of the judgment than that?
Well, again, in hindsight, maybe you can judge it in that fashion. But I think, again, you have to look at Mr. Labuddy's testimony and what his intent and what his advice was based on at the time he made the decision. And, Your Honor, I think it's clear that the cases clearly state that a lawyer, the court may not agree with the lawyer's decision or advice, but that does not render the lawyer liable to a third party. And I think that's the concern here, is whether Mr. Labuddy is liable to a third party under those circumstances.
One of these defendants is held liable. Is there any fight about whether Michael Best is liable?
Michael Best was... They're obviously partners with Michael Best and Friedrich. They have vicarious liability under those facts. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Young?
Section 893.40, the statute of repose, 20 years. This court can resolve the questions that have been raised about that, consistent with State v. Hamilton, by holding that that statute applies to money judgments. The judgment in State v. Hamilton was a money judgment for child support arrearages. The present case does not involve a judgment for a fixed amount. The amount that Robert would be leaving to his children on his death wouldn't be fixed until his death. There would be no way until he died to determine what that amount was, and no way to take any action on the judgment until then. The statute itself does not define the phrase action on a judgment, and I believe that the historical evidence, to the extent we have it, shows that this has been applied for money judgments to money judgments for a specific amount. That would not apply here.
Counselor, your opposing counsel, when I asked him what was the best reason why this judgment isn't enforceable in Wisconsin, gave me a choice of law answer, saying that the judgment has to be enforceable against Robert before you can hold Attorney Labuddy liable for aiding and abetting in its violation. And he says the place where it has to be enforced against Robert is Florida, because that was Robert's domicile, and since he was died at the time of the enforcement action, you were actually enforcing it against his estate.
Tell me what you think of that argument.
I think it means that, if that argument is correct, it means that Wisconsin residents who are subject to judgments in Wisconsin courts can evade those judgments simply by moving to another state.
Well, they could record them in the other state.
They could be recorded in the other state, but the person who's trying to evade them wouldn't have any incentive to do that.
Well, his argument was basically a choice of law argument, and I understand why he's saying that. Can you give me a counter argument about why Wisconsin should be an appropriate choice of law for enforcing this judgment?
Here, we're not talking about a choice of law, like which statute applies, Wisconsin or Florida. We're talking about whether Robert remains subject to a judgment duly entered in Wisconsin representing a stipulation, incorporating a stipulation he voluntarily made, whether he should be subject to that judgment even if he moves to another jurisdiction.
Okay.
And I think the answer has to be yes, or simply leaving the state, adopting another domicile, would liberate you from constraints of any judgment entered against you in Wisconsin action.
Yeah, I think his position was really more because you're talking about property and his estate is being probated in Florida. But if I understand you correctly, you think you could have maybe started a probate action again in Wisconsin? There was apparently a house in Delafield, Wisconsin, and brought the judgment as part of that action, too?
Well, if the question is whether he remains bound by the Wisconsin judgment.
The question that's bothering me is where could you enforce the judgment? You tried to enforce it in Florida. That didn't work.
It didn't
could you have also tried to, instead of enforcing it in Florida, brought all your actions in Wisconsin?
Because he was domiciled in Florida, that's where the probate was.
Right.
And the question was whether the Wisconsin judgment could be enforced there.
Right.
And because of Florida statute of limitations regarding domestication of foreign judgments, it couldn't. But that does not mean that he was scot-free from his judgment in Wisconsin. I hope I'm understanding your question.
I think you are. It's just something that just occurred to me, whether the judgment is enforceable in both places. And if I understand you, you could have enforced it in Florida if it had been domesticated there, but it wasn't. But just because it wasn't available enforcement there doesn't mean an action on the judgment couldn't be brought in Wisconsin.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. I understand.
I'm sorry. Go
that's
ahead.
Okay. No, I just wanted to be sure I understood your position.
The idea that it might have been domesticated in Florida, nobody saw any reason to do that. Nobody knew Robert was violating it. The children, the three plaintiffs, were totally unaware of the provisions in the agreement and in the judgment until Robert had died. So anyone who wanted to hold Robert to that judgment and therefore would want to domesticate it when he relocated his domicile, domesticated in Florida, wouldn't have known that that was a move they should take.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Young,
could
you explain to me what the advantage is of having Mr. Haberman as a defendant? I mean, you prevailed in the trial court, but you are the appellant here. What is the advantage of having Mr. Haberman as a defendant? What motivated you to appeal?
There are two kinds of damages that we believe Attorney Haberman's admitted negligence caused. One is the reduction in the amount of the bequest that the children received. A reduction that resulted from Connie both taking her statutory share and then also receiving under the inter vivos trust. Now, in the event there was a settlement, but the settlement reflected Connie's right to do both those things, and she couldn't have done both those things unless Haberman had negligently advised Robert. There's a second category of damages, though, that's even clearer, I think, and that is that because Haberman did not advise Robert about the Florida law and let Robert decide whether he wanted to let Connie double dip or not double dip, the question of whether Robert's intent was to double dip or not became something that had to be litigated in the probate proceedings. And to mitigate their damages and protect their rights, the Tensfeld children had to intervene in the probate proceedings, incur litigation costs there, and in the course of that, the probate court in Florida imposed a $444,000 hit on their share of the estate, which was paid instead to Connie's lawyers for benefiting the estate. And we're claiming that no matter what Robert would have decided had he been properly advised, at least Robert would have said, I want it this way or that way. I want to let Connie double dip, or I want to prevent her. And in either way, we'd have a clear record, and there wouldn't have been any reason to litigate it in the probate proceedings, and all those litigation costs would have been saved. That's the advantage of, that's why we believe Attorney Haberman is liable here. If that's responsive to your question, I hope.
That raises a different causation matter, does it?
There's two sorts of causation involved in Attorney Haberman's case. One, both focus on the question, what would Robert have done if Attorney Haberman had advised him about this quirk in Florida law and said, what do you want to do? Do you want Connie to double dip, or do you want to prevent her? The damages consisting of the loss of bequest result from the fact that Robert, or so we say, Robert would have prevented Connie from double dipping. We believe that, we talked about that earlier, the memorandum that Haberman wrote after the October 1999 conference with Robert supports that. It's at least enough evidence to get that question to the jury, and we believe actually there's no other significant evidence and it warrants summary judgment on that issue for the Tensvelts. But the other causal path, doesn't depend on what Robert would have decided. It simply depends on his deciding something. And if he decided something, then this would not have been a dispute in the probate court. The Tensvelts wouldn't have retained Foley and Martin to represent them. They wouldn't have had this penalty imposed on them by the probate court. And so that's a very separate and clearer, I think, causal path.
Counsel, if I could just ask one more statute of limitations question so that I can have this down. The 20-year statute of limitations, you say, does not apply because this is not a money judgment, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what statute of limitations applies to the will drafting portion of the stipulation?
It would apply, I think, under this court's ruling in Hamilton, it would apply to the maintenance that Robert owed?
I don't mean the 20 years. I've got that part done. But the part that you're disputing here, the part that this is, the crux of this case is sub 5, will in favor of children. Right?
Yes.
Okay. So what is the statute of limitations for enforcement of that provision? Is it 1 year from discovery that it wasn't done? Is it a breach of contract? Is it, what is it? What's the statute of limitations that would apply to that portion of the stipulation?
Well, I think this goes back to some questions that Justice Rogensack was asking. We really don't have, Robert had a number of wills, the buddy drafted wills, that were not in compliance with that provision of the divorce judgment. At any point before he died, though, Robert could have said, okay, I can't live myself, I have to abide by my promise, or something like that, and ask the buddy to do a will that was compliant with the judgment. So it's a little hard to talk about when the statute of limitations would start running unless it starts at Robert's death, when we know for sure that he did not carry out his promise in the court order.
So are you saying it's a discovery, it sounds like, right? Okay.
Yes.
And what's the time period within which they would have to assert their claim that there wasn't compliance with that portion of the stipulation?
I don't know.
Okay, that's,
and
that's what I'm
saying. I can check on that if you would like, and I can communicate to the court about that. In fact, the children raised this issue almost immediately in Florida probate court. And tried to mitigate their damages on this, and within, I believe the present action was filed in 2007. Was it seven?
I don't know. I have the
phone. 2005.
2005.
Okay.
Oh, he died in 2000.
That's the time frame we're talking about. I can send the court a letter regarding that question if you'd like.
To me, that's important. You know, you can't revive something that's dead. But if the statute of limitations period starts from 2000, what is it? If it starts from 74, how would that be? That's important to me.
Well, my as to when it started, I believe it would have to be at Robert's death. And in fact, if the 10 12 children hadn't learned almost immediately after Robert's death, the same time Attorney Haberman learned actually about the divorce judgment, then there might be a discovery rule addition onto that accrual date. How long they had after the cause of action accrued to actually file a claim based on that is, I'm not sure.
Well, why isn't done a claim on the judgment? Your position is the judgment lasts beyond the 20 years, doesn't it?
Correct.
Now they've got a claim based on that judgment, that he failed to adhere to the judgment, right?
Yes.
That judgment's still good.
I'm having trouble hearing.
That judgment is still good,
yes,
according to your argument.
Good.
Right. So there's no, according to your argument, there's no statute of limitations on this judgment.
I think that might well be the answer.
That fits your argument.
I'm sorry?
That fits your argument.
Yes, it does. I agree. But I'm slightly hesitant because
you don't have to go 20 years because you got it in five, right?
Yes.
So you don't have to worry about 20 years. You just have to worry about less than five.
I think so. And I would want to review.
No one's raised that issue, have they?
No, they haven't, actually. But I still am not confident enough to represent to the court what that statute of limitations, if any, would be. So that's why I'm a bit hesitant here.
Thank you, Mr. Young.
I have a light left. Oh, there's a light. I have a
light. Really done. All right, Mr. Schwimm, you have about 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Going back to the statute of limitations issue, we believe, first of all, that I believe it's 895-40 with respect to actions on the judgment, as interpreted by the state of Wisconsin, was clear that it was a 20-year statute of limitations. And from that point on, this judgment, with respect to the compliance with the divorce stipulation, barred the claim. When the Tenfield children got to the Florida probate court, and first of all, the trial court planned alternative causes of action, one based upon the stipulation and one based upon the judgment, obviously that the court held that both claims were barred. When they got to the Court of Appeals, part of the dispute was whether the stipulation had been merged into the judgment so that the 20-year statute of limitations with respect to the judgment applied. The Tenfield children argued, no, that this was an agreement that existed outside the judgment and therefore was enforceable, and that the statute of limitations did not commence to run until the date of Robert's death, because that's when his will became final. What that means in this case, obviously, once again, is that after 1994, there was no court order that was enforceable with respect to this agreement. Now, look at it a different way. And I think part of the reason why the divorce stipulations are drafted as such, so that the agreement or the terms of the stipulation apply and are separate from the judgment, is to avoid this 20-year statute of limitations issue. So that when you have situations, the contractual obligations will continue to survive as opposed to a judgment, which does have a definite life. Second point.
Are you arguing issue preclusion based on the Florida's court's decision that the stipulation is separate?
No, we're not arguing.
I didn't think so.
No, we did not argue as issue preclusion. But what we're, again, looking at is, again, what the basis of their underlying action is. And we believe it's for the breach of an agreement to make a will.
Okay. If this was a breach of an agreement, when did the statute of limitations run?
At the time of Robert's death.
Immediately?
Immediately. Because it's a breach of contract claim that's not subject to the...
Well, if the breach was at his death, right? Because the will didn't provide it. Right?
Right. That's
why doesn't it run? Why doesn't your contract claim run from the date of death? Well, not really the date of death, when the will is probated, and then you know that he didn't abide by the contract.
That would be the time that the statute commences to run.
Right. And how many years is that statute of limitations?
6 years, I believe.
Did they file this timely then?
Well, the contract action is done, isn't it? Isn't that what was litigated in court and there's a final judgment?
What about this action? When does this statute of limitations run against your clients?
It's 6 years from the discovery of the legal malpractice, I believe.
But that's for the breach of contract, and the breach of contract would be Robert's breach.
Right.
So the claim against Robert or his estate, they had 6 years, you're saying, to bring a breach of contract action. But I think what the chief is asking is what I was asking, which is, bringing a claim against the lawyers is not a breach of contract claim.
Right.
So what's the time period from death to bring the claim against the lawyers? It's not a breach of contract claim for 6 years to come against the lawyers.
I think, again, we would take it from 6 years from the date of the discovery of the claims against Mr. LeBunny.
When does the cause of action accrue here?
The cause of action against the attorneys for the legal malpractice. Once again, we're stating from the date of discovery of the malpractice.
So that would be the date of death.
The alleged malpractice.
So is it the date of probate? Is it the date of the resolution of the Florida Court of Appeals decision so they know what the probate is? I mean, when does the cause of action here accrue? What are you arguing when it accrues?
We didn't raise that as an issue on appeal, so... speaking from the top of my head, I would state that it would accrue from the date the Tensville children discovered the claims against either Mr. Haberman or Mr. Labuddy.
Thank you.
Absent that, any further questions?
I guess I had not fully appreciated the fact that with respect to Mr. Haberman, there are arguably two different causes of action and two different issues about causation. Do you want to address that at all?
Sure. Although in our agreement I said I would not talk about Mr. Haberman's issues on rebuttal, but I'm happy to respond to the court. And as we view this case, and as the trial court viewed the case, it's just one cause of action. It's a cause of action for legal malpractice, for failure to advise Robert with respect to the Bravo decision. We believe causation, an essential element of that causation, is what Robert would have done had he been so advised. And the trial court held that that's very special. All the damages have to flow from that. With respect to Mr. Young's argument that there's two causes of action, the second of which liability for the legal fees, he ignores the fact that the trial court found, and we agree that with respect to that, it was the actions of Connie, who filed the claim against the estate, who elected under her statutory rights and filed a claim, as well as their actions in filing a claim of the estate, that caused them to incur the attorney's fees that they now claim. Put it a different way, had Robert died, and had the Tensville children and Connie Tensville allowed this estate to proceed as provided in the estate plan, Robert's intentions would have been fully complied with. Because there is, with respect to the will itself, it was in full compliance with Robert's intent. I believe my time's up, so unless there's any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shrimp. Are there any further questions? I want to thank both Mr. Shrimp and Mr. Young on behalf of the court. for arguing a rather different and complicated statute of limitations case involving two states and the statute of limitations on judgment, which we haven't had at least since Hamilton. So thank you, and that concludes our argument 07AP1638 Tensville versus Haberman et al. We are expecting students to come in from different schools, and the court will take a short recess to allow the present students to leave and the other students to enter the courtroom.
Thank you very much.